I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 31st, 2016. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Stoltz and Senator Stedman, as well as myself, Senator Giesel. I expect the four other members of the Resources Committee to join us shortly. They've been tied up in Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you to Ann and to Christy, who are helping us out today, recording the minutes and also helping us with the audio. So today the committee has two items to take up. One is the confirmation of Mr. Dave Cruz to the board of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and the second item is Senate Bill 205. So first of all, we'll start out with Mr. Cruz's confirmation. So welcome. If you would come forward, Mr. Cruz. We have a copy in a member's packets of the fact sheet regarding AGDC, as well as your application for appointment. So we've got those materials. If you would just introduce yourself and why you wish to continue to serve on AGDC.
So my name is Dave Cruz. I am born and raised Alaskan. Our family has been here for almost 90 years, and I've been an industry person since 1976. I was very fortunate to come right out of high school, right on the pipeline, and have been involved in construction, oil and gas, and marine aspects. I've been a business owner for over 30 years and currently head up cruise companies that we have operations, construction operations, oil field operations, marine operations in Alaska, North Dakota, Washington State, and Fort McMurray, Alberta. So it's, and I have taken this project here that I've been on the board for AGDC since the conception. I've served as a board member, and I've served as the vice chair. I've served as the interim president, and currently I am the chairman of the board. So it's, as I feel this project is an essential project to the state of Alaska. We are an energy export state, and I feel this gas pipeline is one of is the most important project we have in front of us to have it, to bring it online, have a successful operation. As I say, in my, this is my 40th year in this industry, and I'm a fortunate one because I've never wanted for a job in this state. And I want to pass this on to the next generations so they never want a job in this state, that we have these opportunities available for the young folks and for many futures ahead.
Very good. And clearly you've never wanted for a job because you have multiple skill sets. So that's a good thing too. Very good. Any questions for Mr. Cruz? Mr. Cruz, for the record, yesterday, some of the questions, one of the questions you were asked in Labor and Commerce, where we also interviewed you, was who was the legal attorney, who was the attorney for AGDC, if you could put that on the record here.
Okay, to answer your question, so AGDC, the general counsel for AGDC was a gentleman by the name of Ken Basser. He was a contractor. Ken retired at the start of this year, and we at the board, we hired John Burns to come in and take Ken's place. John had been with AGDC as the board chair. He brought a wealth of experience back. And he is serving as our general counsel now.
Very good. Any other questions for Mr. Cruz? Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. Cruz. There's a legislation that's just passed the Senate. You've probably observed it, Senate Bill 125, I believe. Do you believe there's a constructive and positive role for ex officios from each House and Senate to serve, to be members of the AGDC board? And what do you see positives, and do you have any constructive criticisms of it?
I have no objection to that. I applaud the legislature for creating AGDC. I feel it gives us our opportunities that we need. We're in a position right now that the state of Alaska has never been in, is we're an equal partner in AKLNG. And if it's the legislature's wish to have two members sit on our board, I would not oppose it.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes. First of all, welcome, Senator Wilkowski. I know you just left the Judiciary Committee.
Moving your bill out of committee.
Well, thanks. Wow. Thanks for being here. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. The philosophy of the board is something that we've talked about as a committee and as a legislature over the years. Do you feel the board is more of a technical working board or more of a policy-making board?
Well, this board here, from conception, this is not a rubber stamp board. Board members are required to be active on committees and where they bring expertise to the committee. So, like myself, I've served as the chair of the tech committee, which our main function is, we call it the PEC committee, PEC, which is permits, engineering, and construction. Can't do a project without permits, and everything follows through. We have a commercial committee that we have people with a finance background that serve on that, as well as communication committee and a governance committee. So we look at the strengths and bring folks, depending on what their background. If you had all technical people, they'd maybe not be good commercial folks. So we try and put these in, and as in a policy, this board is, I will tell you, it's the largest requirement of time anybody that comes on here. So when I look at this, and we are going to, you know, possibly have some legislators on here, is this is a big commitment, and it's not a once a month and show up. It's a lot of activities and a lot of sitting in, but what you're doing there is you're working with the staff, you're working with other agencies on this to try and get this project to move forward. So it requires a huge amount of volunteer time.
Very good. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
I don't know if you talked about this right before we came in or not, but do you have any experience building pipelines or building LNG plants or marketing gas or anything like that?
Yep, I've got a lot of experience. So my companies that I control, I have built pipelines. I have done a lot of work. I had a maintenance contract in the late 80s for Alyeska Pipeline. Wasn't building one, but it was doing maintenance work on it. I worked on the original Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Another company that I control, Alaska Interstate Construction, has been on every major North Slope pipeline for the last 30 years. So I do have a good level of experience in it. I was a president of Associated General Contractors of Alaska, so I understand the relationships and the contracting community and what capabilities, you know, Alaskan contractors have. Very, very familiar with it. I have worked on large plants. I have worked at Terminal Camp under contract to Alyeska Pipeline and a maintenance project also. So I've been able to grow in this industry from a young man and have had lots of opportunity to interface on this type of project.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Do you find that there's an appropriate level of expertise on the board as it's currently composed, or do you feel you're lacking in any area?
So that's a very good question, Senator. At the initial start of AGDC, we had to stand up a corporation that didn't exist, and we had to bring levels of expertise in to make this corporation stand up. Today, AGDC is a running, operating machine. So it's not requiring, you know, so much a bunch of pipeline guys, you know, all tech guys, because we've gotten past that point. So we were successful to be able to deliver the ASAP project to a Class 3 estimate with a 20% contingency factor last year. We're very proud of that. That project is now on hold. Under AKLNG, you have a project that is well planned, well funded, moving forward, that you're just basically monitoring it and you're adding, you know, in the technical side. We're interfacing constantly, AGDC, our technical folks, with the AKLNG folks on cost-saving measures or permits that we may have required, or we've shared a lot of data back and forth, so it's really not a situation here that I want a whole bunch of engineers sitting next to me to try and facilitate this project. You know, we need people that have a commercial background, we need people that have a labor background, we have a good, well-rounded board today. That's how I would feel on it, and we work cohesively as a group.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess you're the constant of the AGDC board. You've observed it before December 1st, 2014, and afterwards to now. It was described now that it has people that are standing up for Alaska instead of a bunch of oil executives. Can you just give us a description of what your take is, having served with all the members, and maybe you heard the characterizations? Was it tilted before, and with non-Alaskan rep, with folks that had views antithetical to the interests of Alaskans, and where is it now? And given that you're the constant. And I know this is not probably the question you wanted to answer.
I'll be happy to answer that. So I'll tell you, at that time, we had a great wealth of knowledge that has done that dealt with some large-scale pipelines. Currently, not, you know, the Trans-Alaska. And so that was a help at that time. None of our board members I ever felt were a special interest group. You know, I felt they were sincere. They took the, we took an oath to do what was the best for the state of Alaska, and that's what we abided by. And so that I felt that at that time, and the wealth that we put together, the wealth of knowledge, worked very, very well. I didn't ever feel it was tilted, but this, our current board makeup right now, I will tell you that I can call on any board member at any time and ask them, can you go down and take care of this, or could you be involved in this, or could you volunteer to do something, and they will do it. And we have I'm happy. I was happy with both of them when we started out. Everything was new and fresh, and we set out with a mission, and we completed that mission. And that was our initial mission, was the ASAP project, and I'm very proud of that endeavor, because I saw a project get built from a stand-up to a Class 3 estimate, which is good enough to go to bond and good enough to go to bid for.
Thank you. Appreciate that clarification from your perspective.
Right.
Thank you, sir.
So I'll ask for more questions. Actually, Senator Stedman is next with questions, but I want to make sure that Senator Coghill, welcome, and Senator Costello. Also, Mr. Hugh Short, another AGDC board member, is in the audience. Senator Stedman, you are next for a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, I don't have any problem with Mr. Cruz's appointment, and I think we should be thankful we have Alaskans come forward to serve with his background. But I was wondering, Madam Chairman, if we could possibly have a little bit of leeway, and since that we have him here, I know he has experience in Alberta, and maybe he could take a couple minutes and just kind of give us a quick synopsis of what he sees going on in Alberta. I think it's critical to other things that we do here, and we rarely have the opportunity to have somebody that has exposure in Alberta to share with us in the current. I mean, there might be something good in what he says, and there might not be. I have no idea.
Mr. Cruz.
Kind of like when you talk.
So, okay. Well, the one thing that's very interesting about Fort McMurray is if I took you to Willow, Alaska, we could be in Willow, Alaska, or we could be in Fort McMurray. The terrain, the trees, the everything is very, very similar to Willow, Alaska, and it's remarkable. What you see, though, in Alberta is you see I had a lease map that showed the Alberta oil sands, which in English is 180 miles this way by 140 miles this way. And it's a Saudi Arabia and North America. And the remarkable thing is you don't have four companies, five companies there. You have 100 companies. And the other thing that was remarkable to me when you saw the developments is, and I'm probably exaggerating this, but I've worked in North Dakota also, so I can talk to you about production and drilling to production. But what was remarkable to me, it appeared to me that they start talking about a pipeline in September, and it's done the end of March. And there's just not a lot of, the government is not getting in the way there. They're actually facilitating these projects. In Fort McMurray, you saw the original pictures that National Geographic or someone that's against it wants to show you, which was the earlier oil sands, but there's all, where you had an open pit mine, you had a tailings pond, just like a similar mine that had a sheen on it. Those sheens are being cleaned up. That mining is being reclamated, so when you look at an area that was mined 5 years ago, it looks like something that Usabelli does today. It's hard to tell. Where was the mine? Well, it was right there. The other thing you see now is the next generation, which is SAGD, which is steam-assisted lift. So you'll see a pad that has 10 vertical wells, and then right behind it, they've got a 45-degree well going down that's a steam line, and they use the gas coming off there to generate enough steam so they can lift that heavy oil up. And those are smaller complexes, so you'll come into a wooded area. It's not a huge industrial complex there, but there'll be a small pad that's, and when I say it's, you know, it's a couple acres in there that has got the station on it, and you'll see these wells in there. And a lot of the technology that they do today is very similar to Alaska. Use of ice roads, use of different geotextiles, and just the approach to getting it done. There's not, it's a very positive environment, so you see a lot of acceleration and excitement going forward, but it is Willow, Alaska.
And if follow-up, Senator Stibman.
Maybe give us a hint of what you see in the current economic trends there. And maybe in the Dakotas, if you have operations there.
Yeah, so Alberta has slowed down quite a bit. We still have work there, and it has slowed down. But those investments in the oil sand are not a short-term investment. They're looking at a 40-year lifespan. It's not anything make a quick buck and leave. They're long-term investments in Alberta. The Dakotas are a different environment. It's one that was very educational to me. Our company went down there in 2010 because we had slowed down in Alaska, and the first thing that was apparent to me that you know, I came down there as an Alaskan guy and watching this industry go and thought, boy, we are some of the best at developing oil wells in the United States. You know, the Alaskan model, we're the cleanest. There's, you know, working on ice and you can't tell we were even there the next year. And I went down to North Dakota, and the first thing that I'll take this to the day I'm not here anymore is we had everything was to get paid as a contractor. We were 80 days. And, you know, and it was a stretch for our company because we are growing and growing and growing there, and it's taking 80 days to get paid. And finally, I talked to one of the majors that we were working for. And they came back and they kind of looked at me funny. I said, why does it take so long to get an invoice processed on work that you approved and done? And they looked at me and they said, well, it takes us 60 days to get oil. We just wanted a few extra days so we're not going to get ourselves into a, you know, into a cash problem. And I can remember I specifically asked this manager, so you're telling me you go to drilling to production in 60 days? And he said, yes. And I said, you will never hear another problem from me. I could not believe that the industry had the technical expertise to do that. Here, it's 10 years. So that's when I knew that we were probably not the smartest guys out there in this drilling game, that we had got accustomed. A lot of our problems are, you know, permitting and long-term investments and just the challenges that all Alaskan construction projects face, but I will never forget that meeting that we had that morning and that 80 days. And so today, you know, it's very, the industry, folks in Alaska don't see the industry. But if we were sitting in Dickinson, North Dakota, there'd be five pump jacks out this window and we wouldn't even see them because we've seen them, you know, for better parts of our lives. So that was one of the biggest things. North Dakota is down right now. But the ability of that type of oil field is it's a flick of a switch and it comes back up, unlike Alaska where you cannot let this thing go cold.
Follow-up, Senator Stibman?
No, I just appreciate the insight because we struggle here and we have for years on the time element from permitting to production, and some of us might be retired in just a life of, you know, one endeavor for, you know, comes to fruition. And if North Dakota can do it in 60 days, I wish we could do it in 120.
But one of the other things, Senator, on that is you got to remember your permitting agency is really, it's a little different. You're dealing with a rancher or a farm owner, so that's the first level you get by, but they're usually welcoming you to their property. They have terms and conditions. You just don't go on. You don't, just like here, you don't make a mess and that. But the drilling permit, I can remember that was a little bit of a, made me smile. The drilling permit in 2010 from North Dakota was 7 days. And if you ask, you could probably get it faster, but that's, you know, that's what our competition is doing. So I came back and spoke of our competition. So.
Thanks, Madam Chairman.
So, Mr. Cruz, you mentioned that Alberta was slowing down a bit. How is the government responding to the low cost or the low price environment?
Well, the national Canadian government changed, and they are, I think they had the approach that the industry was making too much money, so they wanted to change the tax structure, which didn't help them out at all. And then the Alberta government changed it almost for the same and created another huge problem. So much to the effect that you have low oil prices, then you have a sovereign changing the terms again. And there's some very good deals on oil field equipment in Alberta right now. And that's unfortunate because that is a large, it's like Alaska in a lot of ways because it has such a large energy business there.
So when you say there's lots of good deals on oil field equipment, you're saying that companies are paring down?
They are paring down substantially there. Okay. Because they had a very, very strong market, and then it goes away. So I remember one time, this is years ago, but on a bad year, Alberta drilled, this is gas and oil, 16,000 wells. Mm. Alaska did 70. So.
Very good. Further questions? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cruz, I guess, how do the communications go between the administration and you? What is your conduit for communications? Is it the governor's office or one of the commissioners?
So the state gas line team is AGDC, administration, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Revenue, AG, and that team. We have a weekly meeting, and we constantly are interfacing on different issues as this project has moved forward. There's many, many moving parts to it. So there's good open communications between that team. We operate on a critical path schedule. We operate with a RACI chart, which is, you know, responsibility, accountability, consulted, and informed. And I feel that it's working well. This came about this year. We're able to operate as a team and focus on facilitating a project to get done. We have very good relations when we have our sponsors meetings. You have the heads of Conoco, Exxon, BP, as well as in most cases the governor shows up. Deputy Commissioner is at that meeting. I'm at that meeting. The president or interim president of AGDC is at that meeting, and those are day-long meetings, and there's lots of participation. So there's, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it is a good level of communication between that state gas line team.
Sure. Just to follow up?
Yes, follow up, Senator Stoltz.
Is there any member of the board, one of them from the administration or somebody that's not on the board from the administration, if you hear from them, you know that's a direct line from the governor? Or, I mean, is there somebody that you feel that's de facto the designee of the governor for the...
In the sense the governor wants this or wants that?
Yeah.
No. No, I can pick up and call the governor up in a minute, and maybe not get an answer, but he will get back to me. I can call the commissioner. So we don't have anybody that has better access to the governor than board chair or vice chair or our president.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Do you, could you talk about the level of independence at the AGDC? Do you feel you're given a wide array of independence, or do you believe that you're sort of under the thumb or being pressured by the executive branch at all?
No, I don't. I believe that all of our board members and our executive team take this corporation very serious. We have a responsibility to do, I use this statement, you guys have probably heard it, but it's you do what's best for Alaska. You have a responsibility to Alaska as well as this legislature, the administration, all Alaskans. So we hold that very seriously. We take that into account. We are not a rubber stamp board at all.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Topic, but on your budget for next year, if I'm recalling correctly, the House funded your budget and the Senate zeroed it out. I could be wrong on that, but do you have any understanding what the budget is for FY17?
I would have to look at those numbers again, but I need you guys to make certain that we have this thing funded.
Follow up. Yes.
And when you make requests for funding, if we don't fully fund it, what would be the impacts to AGDC?
Then we're not going to be able, number one is we're not going to be able to complete our mission. So we have one thing we have operated as is we are, I feel we do a good fiduciary responsibility to spend this money wisely, be accountable for it, and give you results for it. And so that is always on our mind. So we have pared it down. We understand Alaska's financial condition. I don't think anybody would argue that, but we do have to have money to operate. This is a world-class project, and we cannot pull back on this project. We have been an energy exporter for over 40 years. If you look at ConocoPhillips' operation in Nikiski, the pipeline is, we're going on 39th year for Trans-Alaska. We're good at it, and we need to continue on.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
With the downturn in the price of oil, I know that our partners are concerned, BP, Conoco, Exxon, about spending money on this project, a whole lot of money anyway. Do you have concerns that maybe we should wait until oil prices rise again, or would that set us back further in moving this project along?
So my own feeling is if we had $100 a barrel oil, every economist and every CEO would be worried because we don't know what the bottom of this thing looks like. Hopefully we've seen the bottom at 26, and I mean, I was thoroughly excited last week when I saw $39. I can remember when oil hit 50 in about 2005, I never thought it would get that high. But to me, now is not the time to cut back on this project because it's still a lot of planning and things in place. One of the milestones at AGDC that I'm very, very proud of, and I constantly correspond with our head of permitting is we will have permits, record of decision in the BLM or Corps of Engineers 404 permit this year for a right of way from Prudhoe to Point McKenzie. That's usually one of the things that slows a project down as we get hung up on a permit. And AGDC has the ability to hand those permits for a price, we're not giving them away, to AKLNG that can facilitate a project. So that's usually one of the stalemates. That's because you guys have kept us funded and we've never stopped working. If we slow this project down and oil goes to 65 in 2 years and you start back up, you're going to miss that window of 2022 or 2023 for having first gas, or 2025. You will miss that. And that's not the time, you know. So I firmly believe that we need to keep working diligently on this project and keep it funded. We will do our level best to be accountable for this money. We are accurate on our budgets and continue to be able to answer these tough questions. But unless you're ready to go, the world will pass you by, and then we'll all sit here and say, well, we should have. Wish I could have.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Rutkowski.
Some legislators have expressed concern or criticism about what they perceive as being a lack of transparency within AGDC. I've heard complaints about decisions being made in executive session and not being people who are watching really not being able to follow along what's happening. Do you think that's fair criticism?
Well, from perception, that's what might be what it appears. But when we're dealing with a personnel issue, you know, that some of those require executive session. We do not take any action in executive session. We understand what it's for and why we utilize it. And I encourage all members to come to one of our board meetings and participate. And we are always open to it. But I will tell you from the decisions are not being made in special session. We are very open and we are very, very cognizant of why you go into special session and what you can discuss in special session.
Follow-up, Senator Rutkowski.
Or executive session, excuse me.
Are you familiar at all with the Alaska Gasoline Port Authority? Were you involved in that at all?
No, I was not involved with AGPA.
There's been, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rutkowski.
There's been some concern, and I think the way it was phrased was sort of like Walker's putting the AGPA, the Alaska Gasoline Port Authority gang back together. And do you have any concerns about that? Do you see any members who have certain agendas, maybe pushing Alaska Gasoline Port Authority agenda that may not be in the best interests of the AGDC or the state?
I can tell you at no time has anyone pushed going back to AGPA. You know, we have, like I said, you're going to change this thing, you stall a permit or something, we're going to miss a deadline. So there's never been this project, AKLNG, won't work, we should do something different. I don't like, you know, that ASAP, no, that's not the right way to go. There has never been, from any of the gas line team or any board member, that has opposed the current path that we're on. We're very clear on that mission statement. It was very well, you guys crafted a very good legislation on what our limits were and what we are to pursue.
Follow-up, Senator Rutkowski.
Confidentiality agreements is something that members in the legislature have talked about quite a bit. Do you have any thoughts on whether there should be confidentiality agreements or shouldn't be within AGDC?
Well, I have all the confidentiality agreements, so I there are certain things. We are a quasi-public-private corporation, and there will be certain things that will need to be held confidential. So I think on items that may be commercial or proprietary or something of that nature, we have not had opposition. I've got our executive staff on proprietary information. They can sign a CA. There's not an issue with it. And when I talk about proprietary, it may be a turbine design, it may be a pump design, it may be something that a vendor is going to bring to us, but it is going to require it. But as the projects go forward, it will be something that will have to be looked at for all the board.
Follow-up, Senator Rutkowski.
Rigdon Boykin, there's been, his name has come up quite a bit when we discuss AGDC, whether or not it was appropriate to hire him, whether or not it was appropriate to pay him what he was paid. Do you have any feelings on Mr. Boykin and his salary and his level of expertise and whether or not he added value to the AGDC or not?
So I did on many times meet with Mr. Boykin, and he was doing his best to try and get this project to move forward. And when I say this project, I'm talking AKLNG, to move forward. We were stalled on some components. Things were slower. The agreements that we needed to have done amongst the partners were stalled. And so that's where Mr. Boykin was focusing his efforts, trying to get the producers to come together, gas balancing, different requirements. I think in the end, if we have a project that comes together in this next year or whenever, then he contributed. If we don't do a project, well, then you say, well, maybe that was not the thing to do, you know, that money could have been spent otherwhere. So only the future is going to tell.
So, Mr. Cruz, you've been asked a couple times, and I'm going to ask you a kind of a third time in another different way.
Okay.
Okay, so Senator Stoltz asked whether you felt that any of the board members were direct conduits to the governor. Senator Wilkowski asked you what you thought the level of independence of the board was, and I think you answered that you felt it was very independent. So my question to you is, just for clarity, do you believe that AGDC is a subdivision of the executive branch or that you are an independent entity?
I believe we are an independent entity, 100%.
Okay, that's what your website says, so I just wanted to confirm that. Very good. Are there further questions for Mr. Cruz? All right, seeing none, I'll open public testimony. I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand, Senator Machicki. And by the way, welcome. Thanks for joining us. I know you were tied up in judiciary.
I was.
Senator...
You're in a bondage just going on.
Yeah, sorry. Senator Machicki.
I actually don't have any questions for Mr. Cruz. He's being reappointed, and I have a lot of faith in your past performance, and I'm excited with some questionable times that you're willing to be reappointed. So just thanks for being here, Mr. Cruz.
Thank you, Senator.
With that, I will open public testimony. I have no one signed up online to testify. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Mr. Dave Cruz's reappointment to the AGDC board? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Any further questions or comments from committee members? All right. Seeing none, Mr. Cruz, thank you very much for being here. In accordance with AS 3905-080, the Resources Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Alaska Gasline Development Corporation Board of Directors, Dave Cruz Palmer, appointed 9/13/13, reappointed 9/14/15, term expires 9/13/2020. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. So with that, we'll sign the document. We'll take a brief at ease while we do that, and then we'll proceed with SB 205. We're back on the record. So the committee will now take up Senate Bill 205. Senate Bill 205 comes by way of the Governor's Department of Natural Resources. The bill is a proposed ratification of the state's royalty contract with Tesoro. We welcome Mr. Jim Shine from the Department of Natural Resources to present the bill. Welcome, Mr. Shine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Shine. I'm a Special Projects Assistant in the DNR Commissioner's Office. Acting Commissioner Rutherford had a scheduling conflict today and was unable to attend, so I am here on her behalf. Senate Bill 205, as you mentioned, is a ratification of a contract for sale of royalty oil from the state to Tesoro. Essentially, when the state has an election for RIV or RIK, those terms being royalty in kind versus royalty in value, we have a choice to take either. When we take it in value, the producer produces the oil on our behalf, transports it to the destination, typically the West Coast markets, and then net backs to the RIV price, and they sell it on our behalf. In an RIK situation, we take possession of the oil and sell them ourselves. When we elect either, we have to make a best interest finding that the statute 3805-182 says that it's RIK is the default, but we have to make a best interest finding that we are taking RIK. Conversely, we also have to make a best interest finding if we're taking royalty and value. So we commenced this process through a solicitation of interest that went out January of 2015 to all the in-state refineries, gauging market interest in purchasing royalty oil. The last bullet point on this first slide here indicates that we receive all royalties as RIV right now. That's kind of an anomaly. We've historically, dating back to 1979, have sold royalty in kind to in-state producers, starting with MAPCO, Williams, Petrostar, Flint Hills, and Tesoro. Today, because the contract with Tesoro terminated on January 31st, 2016, we're currently taking all of our North Slope royalties in value. But as that bullet indicates, we regularly take royalties in kind and market them ourselves. As I indicated, we have to make a best interest finding that taking RIK is in the state's best interest. As part of that, we're directed per statute to sell by competitive bid unless the market doesn't, there's not adequate competition. And when the responses to the solicitation of interest, we received responses from BP and Conoco, which have North Slope topping plants for in-field use. Their response was that they would take volumes, but they were not interested in processing them in-state. Flint Hills responded that they were not taking volumes because they had closed their doors in June of 2014. We received responses from Petrostar and Tesoro, both indicating a willingness to purchase royalty in kind barrels. Tesoro responded agreeing to the price terms that we had put out in the solicitation, whereas Petrostar responded indicating they would like to purchase barrels but at a different pricing mechanism that was not as advantageous to the state and not in line with the terms that we had in the solicitation. At that time, the commissioner made a determination to proceed that there was not adequate competition based on the pricing responses, and we proceeded with a non-competitive negotiated contract with Tesoro. The decision criteria in 3805-183 direct the commissioner in selling royalty oil to provide the maximum benefit to the citizens of the state. Some of the criteria listed here include the cash value offered, which is the price terms, the effect on the economy, the benefits of refining and providing those refined products in-state, and the eight criteria listed in 3806-070, which are reviewed by the Royalty Board. The best interest finding, as I mentioned before, we issued the preliminary best interest finding on February 3rd, 2016. Attached to that as an exhibit was the proposed contract with Tesoro. That was out for a 30-day public comment period. During that time, we received public comments from Petrostar and its parent corporation, ASRC. The comments that they raised during that 30-day public comment period were addressed and in the proposed final contract that's before the legislature today. We submitted that contract to the Royalty Board, presented it, and the Royalty Board unanimously approved it and recommends that the legislature ratify the contract as well. In AS 3806-070, the Royalty Oil and Gas Development Advisory Board, also known as the Royalty Board, reviewed the contract under the following criteria. They look at the revenue needs of the state, the projected local regional needs for the products, desirability of capital investment and local secondary development, social impacts, and the projected additional costs and responsibilities put on the state. Additional criteria include the existence of labor and consumption markets, potential environmental positive and negative impacts, and the projected proposed transaction upon commercial enterprises. And as I mentioned, the Royalty Board, after considering the contract in line with these criteria, did unanimously approve the contract. The actual contract before the legislature for ratification is a 5-year contract for a sale of 20 to 25,000 barrels of royalty oil per day. Tesoro takes possession of those at the Valdez Marine Terminal and then barges them over to the Tesoro Nikiski refinery. The formula that we use to determine is on the next slide, but it's, as I mentioned, the RIK versus an RIV valuation methodology. In the royalty and value world, the producers net back. When they transport from the Valdez Marine Terminal to the West Coast, there's a marine transportation deduction that is netted back off of the final sales price, the ANS West Coast price. In an RIK situation, we don't have that marine transportation because we're not sending it from Valdez down to the West Coast. So you essentially start with a U.S. West Coast average, and then you deduct a $1.95 RIK differential, which is meant to represent the value of a price of oil sold in-state. Some of the other provisions within the contract is if they don't nominate oil for three consecutive months, the contract will terminate. There are provisions. Another question.
Yes. Pardon me, Senator Wilkowski.
Just that $1.95 figure, could you explain that to me?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. I also, for the record, will mention that we have the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Corey Feige, and the commercial manager from Division of Oil and Gas, Alex Novikov, online, who might be able to answer more technical questions. But the commercial section in the Division of Oil and Gas has used the $1.95 RIK differential in the last Tesoro contract, which is, like I mentioned, it's since we don't have a marine transportation deduction, the $1.95 deduction per barrel is meant to reflect the in-state price of a barrel of oil.
I'm not following something here.
Would you like to speak with Corey Feige or
Alex? If either of you can, I mean, maybe Alex can provide more detail on the how we arrived at $1.95.
Alex Novikov, can you hear us?
Yeah, hi.
Welcome.
This is Alex Novikov of Division of Oil and Gas. For the chair, Senator, the way the pricing is arrived at is a net-net pricing valuation, and the formula assumes as a basis over formula West Coast price for the ANS, and then from that West Coast price for ANS, there are deductions to arrive at the price which the state receives, and the deductions include things like tariffs for the taps and relevant upstream pipelines, quality adjustments based on the quality of the crude, and also in cases of RIV pricing, a marine transportation cost deduction, which Mr. Schein has referred to. When we talk about RIK pricing, instead of that marine transportation cost deduction, we have an RIK differential. This RIK differential is what's called a location differential, which mimics and reflects the private transactions which occur for the ANS within Alaska. And that's a deduction to the U.S. West Coast ANS price to come up with a Alaskan price for the transactions within the Alaska without taking the crude to the West Coast.
Thank you, Alex.
Great. Mr. Schein, did you say you had the equation on the next
it's
slide?
It's on the next slide, yes.
Perhaps that would be helpful to look at this time.
Okay. I'll go back to
just to cover the question
slide
right now.
So in red, at the top underneath the heading, you look at the ANS spot price as the starting point for the netback methodology. And the West Coast price for ANS is we use the basis of this is the monthly average of the daily average of the reporting services Platts and Reuters to determine the actual ANS West Coast price to begin the netback process. And then you'll see the $1.95 RIK differential. Then, as Alex had indicated, Mr. Novikov, the rest of the equation is the same as a RIV situation where we have tariff deductions for TAPS transportation, and then there's quality bank adjustments, and then also a small percentage of line loss that's has an equation within the contract. And the quality bank adjustments come that's a FERC jurisdiction, and it comes from the quality bank administrator for those adjustments.
So just for clarification, at the top you have the ANS spot price, and then these other items are subtracted from that to arrive at what the price of the barrel would have been in Alaska.
Madam Chair, so we start with the U.S. West Coast price, and so the net back price of all these deductions gets us to our RIK.
Okay. Further questions on that point? All right, seeing none. Oh, Senator Wilkowski.
And I'm looking ahead on the next page. I'm still just trying to figure out that $1.95. So the oil comes out. The money you're deducting is the money that and on the next slide it talks about a 330 to 370 deduction, which that's what the current deduction would be. And is that the cost to ship it from Valdez to the West Coast, or is that Does the $1.95 represent the in-state transportation cost? Is that what you're saying?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the $3.30 to $3.70 per barrel is the average, as reported by revenue, of marine transportation deductions right now. And you're correct. It's the cost to ship a barrel of oil from Valdez to the destination, and most all of our oil goes to the U.S. West Coast. So that's where that comes from. The $1.95, I don't know how more to explain it, but other it's essentially just the deduction to represent the value of the price of a barrel of oil sold within the state between private transaction and a private transaction.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And I mean, I understand. Okay, so the oil comes down to Valdez, and you're saying, well, if we had shipped it to California, Oregon, wherever, Washington, it would cost $3.30 to $3.70. We don't get a tax on that, right? They get to deduct that. So that lowers the amount of revenue that the state gets. But because they don't have to ship it down there, why are we allowing $1.95? I guess that's my question.
Corey or Alex, if you want to.
Why are we allowing anything?
This question.
So would either of you like to answer that question, either Corey or Alex?
This is Alex Novikov. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The $1.95 is a location differential, and it basically reflects the market dynamic. Even though the crude does not leave the state, when you look at transactions between private buyers and sellers, there is still a location differential. And that location differential is just determined by supply and demand. It's not a transportation deduction of any sort. The $1.95, which we have included in this formula, is a location differential which is within the range we've seen for the private transactions. If you look at the final best interest findings, we have included a table in the best interest finding with Department of Revenue's information for the past and projection, which shows that private transactions within the state of Alaska allow for a location differential. And this $1.95 tries to mimic what would have happened if we looked at a transaction between a producer and a buyer within the state. So it's not a transportation deduction. It's just a reflection of market dynamic between supply and demand.
So, Alex, could I just ask a clarifying question? In that best interest finding, what page will we go to see that table? There are multiple tables in that document.
Yes. If you could just give me a second, let
sure.
me...
It's page 11. It's like 11. Looks like it's page 11 to me, Madam Chair.
Is it page 11?
I don't
have a table on page 11.
It's the weighted average.
Okay, page 11, yes. Page 11 shows the past. So page 11, table 1, shows the past location differentials. If you look at the top, you have marine transportation costs from 2008 starting at $1.93 and increasing rapidly, showing $3.70 by 2021. And then the next three rows shows the RIK differential, which we've used in our past contracts with Flint Hill and Tesoro. And then at the bottom, you see DOR's location differential, which has varied depending on the year from $1.34 to the $2.12. That's the location differential which we've seen in the private contract between buyers and sellers for the sale of crude in Alaska. We also have a table somewhere further down which shows DOR's forecast for location differential going forward. But this is kind of the past of the location differential, which goes from 2008 to 2015.
Follow up on that, Senator Wilkoski?
I'm just trying to get a sense of how much. So it was $1.55 in 2008, $1.57 in 9, and then $1.65 in 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, for, looks like, I guess that's Fort Mills. We're going to $1.95, so that's, 20% increase or so. What? How much does the state lose by having a, for every penny, let's say, of differential? Do you have that calculated?
Alex, this is Jim. Does the commercial section have that on a penny-by-penny basis?
I don't have the number with me right here. We can calculate, you know, the impact of a penny by penny on a barrel and get it to you.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkoski.
Yeah, just what's the rationale for going from $1.65 to $1.95? That's let's see, 60, 70. That's 30-cent difference. And what's the rationale for that? Has the market adjusted that much?
The last contract we had, the last two contracts we had, which were Flint Hill and Tesoro. The Flint Hill contract had $2.15, and contract with Tesoro, which expired in January of this year, had $1.95 of a differential. So the $1.95, which we're proposing for the current contract, is in line with a contract, with a past contract with Tesoro, and is a little bit better than the contract which was in place with Flint Hill. And it's within the range of what we see the location differential for the private contracts in the state.
Follow up, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've sat through a few of these over the years, and I just want to just to the public watching. This is this isn't an amendable measure we have before us. It's a take it or leave it provision. So it's whether or not we trust the integrity of the Walker administration and the negotiators, and whether or not we ratify it. So we talk. You know, we're talking about certainly a good process, understanding how they got to those events. But I just don't want the public to think that we have the power to change any of these dispositions. It's really not whether or not we believe there is integrity and good faith and good business practice by the Walker administration and their designees in the process. I just want to clarify that for the record.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. And best findings, obviously. Okay. Senator Machiki, you had a question.
A couple of questions. Just first, essentially what I hear is you're saying this $1.95 is an assumption that if BP purchased the same quantity from Exxon, that the location differential would be very similar.
Senator, this is Alex Nivikol from Division of Oil and Gas. It's not an assumption. The information which is published by the Department of Revenue is actually based on actual contracts which we have access to between private parties. So the information which the Department of Revenue publishes for the future years is a forecast, so that's an assumption. But the past information is based on the actual contract.
That is a better illustration of my point, and that point is that Tesoro is not getting a special deal. In fact, in their 2014 contract, they had less of a deduction than Flint Hills, and I assume when the Flint Hills contract was written, that sort of the current going price for the location differential between private parties was somewhere around $2.15. Is that correct?
In 2013, it was $2.12. That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe this, I'm not too sure this for, but it's important that we understand how you arrived at this. But it looks to me like we were able to switch between RA royalty in value and royalty in kind much more rapidly than under this contract. So is that the reason for this number being so critical at this point? Or is this based on it looks like you're trying to create a differential on how it would look between royalty in kind, royalty in value, on in-state transportation. But you're chasing the value of that that may not be known until it's sold, I guess, is probably how I would think. So is that what that number is doing, or is it a different methodology?
Alex, do you have an answer? I was just Senator Coghill through the chair. I mean, it's not a transportation deduction. The $1.95 is not. I've mentioned before, I mean, these are market factors to determine that location differential, and it's that $1.95 is a fixed price in the contract over the life of this 5-year contract, and the delta between the $1.95 location differential and the marine transportation deduction that we would otherwise be incurring in an RIV situation is approximately $1.50 to $1.75 per barrel. Over the life of this contract, that difference equates to $45 to $56 million more to the state over RIV. And if we elect RIK, we have to at least be equal to or greater than RIV.
Good. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask a question about the refined products, and I guess we usually think of jet fuel or diesel other motor fuels, but one of the concerns for my constituency involving the construction industry is the refined product of asphalt. And what went into can you give us some discussion of some of the suppliers of that and how that entered? It's a pretty critical part of Alaska's building industry on an annual basis, and not just having a plant, but having one that's apportioned where it's available and cost-effective. And can you give us some discussion about the whole issue of asphalt and who... Which plants are able to provide it and where they're located, and I assume that was part of the discussion.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, I'm not an expert in asphalt or the construction industry, but having we have representatives from Tesoro online and in the room who can probably answer better who they supply asphalt to.
And Madam Chair, I'm not interested as much exclusively in Tesoro. If there's other suppliers that might make asphalt, and they might be economical distribution. Was that discussed by the governor's team, and did that enter into the best findings? It is one of our building ingredients, just like in-state refined oil.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, I mean, selling our royalty oil to in-state refineries, to Tesoro and Petrostar and Flint Hills historically, provides a certain security of supply, their feedstock for producing those products that are used within the state.
So I'm going to suggest that we ask Director Corey Feige, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, if she could offer an answer to Senator Stoltz's question about asphalt supply.
Okay. Am I on?
You were unmuted momentarily, and I think you're muted again, Director Feige.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Thanks very much. This is kind of an awkward setup here. My apologies. But Madam Chair and members of the committee, and through the chair to Senator Stoltz, specifically asphalt and the development of asphalt or the sale of asphalt was not necessarily a part of the best interest finding discussion or the negotiation of the RIK contract, because the RIK contract itself deals with the sale of the ANS crude. What the refiner chooses to use that crude for and what derivative products or refined products come off of that is not a function of the best interest finding. I do believe, and again, as Jim said just a moment ago, that Tesoro can speak to the refined products that that they put out. And then certainly I do recall it being a part of the discussion at one point with Petrostar that they too were also looking at developing an asphalt plant. But again, the division itself does not have access to that information. Those are commercial decisions, obviously, by the refiners, and we focused upon the sale of the ANS crude.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on a decision like this that affects availability, and maybe there should be more departments. Maybe the commissioner of DOT should have been consulted. I think this is a big gap in information. It's certainly
that can exponentially increase the cost of state projects, locally funded projects, and it's a big part of our economy. And I think it's relevant, and I think it's a big gap in the process, because it is, again, one of our building blocks. And you can bust the budget of a project if you have to ship asphalt over a pretty long distance. And I understand, you say, in fact, you don't care what they do with it, it's up to them. But I think that there sounds like there were some discussions with one of the companies bringing that up as a topic, and I just really wish it would have been part of the equation. I think the lack of it makes this an incomplete process. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Senator Stills. I certainly share your concerns, yet on the other hand, if this isn't part of the evaluation process, it isn't part of it, and right now we're looking at a contract before us versus micromanaging the process. But we can certainly ask Tesoro. Senator Machicki, a question?
Whenever you're through, if you're through there, mm-hmm. Anyway. So I'm very interested in your RIK contract terms when it talks about employment of Alaska residents and no discrimination against Alaska companies and residents. Can you tell me what the expectation is there and if Tesoro meets that requirement?
Thank you, Senator Machicki, through the chair. Those are pretty standard terms that we've included in the most recent RIK contracts with other royalty purchasers. The in-state processing, you know, the commercially reasonable efforts is a reasonableness standard. It's a diligence standard. Constitutionally, we have some issues with actually requiring the in-state use of products. I think there was a Supreme Court case dealing with forestry products a few years ago where we limited the processing of forest products to be used within the state, and I believe the U.S. Supreme Court found that unconstitutional. It violated the Dormant Commerce Clause. Similarly, with the employment of Alaska residents, we encourage, as with any contract we have, whether with the Department of Natural Resources, we absolutely encourage employment and local hire. To answer your question about Tesoro's current practices, they employ 210 local Alaskans, bringing $127 million to the local economy on an annual basis. So they do meet that mandate, and we've had no indications that would ever change.
Follow up, Senator Machicki.
That works for me. Thank
you. Okay. Further questions for Mr. Shine? Were there more slides that you wanted to complete?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We've kind of bounced around a few slides. So one of the additional things I was going to mention on this slide is the security bullet point with respect to should Tesoro fall below a certain credit rating, which is BBB negative, then they would be required to provide a letter of credit equal to the value of 90 days of oil delivery. So it's essentially kind of a financial assurance or a bond that protects the state in the event that credit ratings fall below a certain level and they become a higher risk purchaser. But that has not been the case over the last 2 years of our contract with Tesoro, and that we don't expect that to change. But this is provided to give the state some security in that instance.
Pause for a moment. Senator Machicki, question?
I do. Just on basic similarities, Senator Stoltz made an interesting comment. This really is an up or down based on our trust that it's the administration provided an appropriate contract. What are the similarities between this current contract and the previous two contracts?
Senator Machicki, through the chair. The similarities of these two contracts, the only major difference essentially really is in that RIK differential. It was $2.15 for Flint Hills in 2014, but it's been identical, that valuation has been identical in the last 2 years of contract with Tesoro for purchase of royalty barrels. The other difference would be in volume of barrels that were under contract. I believe the Flint Hills contract in 2014, they had a nomination window of 18,000 to 30,000 barrels per day. And then when they closed their doors in 2014, that contract terminated, and so we were no longer delivering those barrels to them.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
So what that says to me is that the department is largely allowed to do their jobs on contractual arrangements, and the Parnell contract is essentially identical to the Walker contract, and although there may be tougher questions depending on which administration you support the most, realistically, the contract's independent and very similar in nature.
Senator Machidi, through the chair, that's correct.
I'll let you go on to the next slide.
Okay. We've kind of covered the RIK contract price valuation. This slide kind of highlights the point I made earlier between the value that we're bringing to the state with this contract that will be estimated $45 to $56 million more over the next 5 years than we would otherwise receive for royalty and value. And I've already mentioned a couple of the other bullet points at the bottom on the DeSoto local hire and impacts for the local economy there.
I have a question about that.
Senator Machicki.
So are you saying, Mr. Schein, that there is more potential profit for one purchasing our oil in RIV than with the state for the party that purchases under RIV rather than a sale such as this, an RIK such as this?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, the purchaser of RIV would be someone on the West Coast. I'm not quite sure I follow the question because we...
Well, if I can restate it, Madam
Please
Chair.
Please do.
If you have 45 to 56 million more value to the state in RIV than... then one would think that this is more profitable to the state and RIV would be more profitable to the other purchasers because you've got a loss in value to the state of $45 to $56 million.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's correct. The delta between the $1.95 location differential and the approximate $3.50 marine transportation deduction in an RIV situation is where the state realizes the most economic benefit in this contract over RIV, and that number equates to $45 to $56 million.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just one last slide about additional royalty oil sales. We currently nominate, if we will nominate up to 95% of our available royalty barrels for sale. We're in current negotiations with PetroStar to provide royalty oil to them over the next 5 years. Those contracts would terminate about the same time as this DeSoto contract. Should we have a situation where we have contracts with DeSoto and PetroStar right now and we have 95% of our volumes nominated and we actually have more additional barrels than we predicted, then we will offer those additional barrels for sale on an equal basis to both contracting parties. And I did mention that PetroStar had raised a number of issues in their public comments to the proposed contract. Those really kind of fall into two buckets. The first would be the length of the contract with DeSoto, and that the initial contract was a five-year contract with the option to extend for 5 years, and that would have to be among mutual consent of the parties, and that would come back before the legislature for ratification. We have since struck that provision out of the contract. That's no longer the case. The contract before you for ratification, for your consideration, is a standalone five-year contract. Another topic, a concern that was addressed was with respect to a pro-ration preference that we afforded to DeSoto in our negotiations in exchange for nominating a little less volume so that we could provide a little bit more to PetroStar. We have provided that, but after some consideration and receiving that comment, we've since struck the pro-ration preference out. So it's status quo if we have our royalty barrels under contract, and there is a field maintenance or a downturn in production and we don't have enough barrels to meet our contractual obligations, then all the royalty purchasers are prorated proportionate to their share.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
I know you talked about it a little bit, but I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more and just tell me the other bids that you received again.
Yeah, sure. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. We sent the solicitation of interest to five refineries within the state, Flint Hills in North Pole, and then PetroStar, Tesoro, and BP and Conoco. The responses from BP and Conoco which have North Slope topping plans for infield use, indicated a willingness to purchase barrels, but they were not planning on refining them within the state. They were going to be added to shipments and be exported out of the state. The response from Flint Hills was they were not interested in purchasing because they were not operating any longer. The response from PetroStar was an indication that they were willing to enter into a non-competitive negotiated process at a pricing mechanism that was not the same as we provided in the solicitation of interest, whereas Tesoro responded affirmatively, indicating a willingness to participate in a competitive bid or a informal negotiated process and met the price term in our solicitation.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
The bids that you received from, I think you said BP and Conoco, was that, were they, would they have resulted in more profit to the state?
I'm sorry,
Senator. Would they have resulted in more revenue to the state?
Senator Wilkowski.
Expected under this?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I think your question is regarding whether or not PetroStar's response would have been...
BP and Conoco. You said BP and Conoco, if I can remember.
Yes, yeah. You are correct.
BP and Conoco have offered to buy our oil, and I'm just curious how the numbers compare. If we would have made more revenue under their proposal. I understand that you're refining in-state, you're providing an in-state product. I'm just, and so I guess it's a little bit hard to get an apples-to-apples comparison, but.
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. The price is just one of the considerations the commissioner has to review when making a best interest finding. Alex can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that they probably met the price term that we were requesting, which is $1.95, but they were seeking to not refine within the state and export it. And with when you consider all of the criteria in 3805-183, we provided more value to the state in selling our RIK to an in-state refiner where the product is going to be refined within the state and providing those refined products to local markets.
This is Alex Novikov. So, Chair, Senator, our discussions with BP and Conoco did not go into the pricing as much. They made indications that they would be potentially interested in bidding for the crude, but they wouldn't be able to meet in-state refining conditions. And given the statute, which requires us to make a best interest finding for any export of crude, that this crude is excess to the in-state demand, we couldn't reach that threshold because indications from PetroStar and Tesoro combined came much to a bigger number than RIK that was available. So we couldn't really make a best interest finding that we have excess crude to sell for export.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just trying to figure out how this works. So did you do a financial analysis on providing the oil to BP and Conoco? Would we get a production tax on that? And did you factor that added value in, corporate income taxes, et cetera?
Alex, do you want to take that question?
Yes. This is royalty oil, and it would make no difference to whom we would be selling it. You know, would it be to Tesoro, PetroStar, or back to producers? The production tax and, you know, other fiscal aspects of the sale would not be different. So in terms of a marginal economic impact, you know, there is no difference who the buyer is.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Senator Wilkowski? Okay. Any other questions? We do have Tesoro in the room for questions, if anyone would like to ask Tesoro questions. Senator Sills, would you like to have Tesoro come to the table?
Madam Chair, I'll ask Mr. Schein.
Okay.
And he can defer if necessary, but when you were looking at these royalty prices, there's been did you look at any of the issues of motor fuel price collusion and affordability? That seems to be a big political topic around here. I'm surprised I'm the guy that raised it.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's not a criteria that is expressly provided in the statute that the commissioner consider. I mean, we look at what the refined products will be delivered to the in-state and be used. but the actual price of fuel is very far removed from the actual sale of the feedstock to the refineries. There is a number of factors that influence the sale of gasoline in the state. The Seattle OPIS price, oil price information service, plus a small percentage differential is typically what sets the market rate for gasoline prices within the state. So between us selling RIK to Petrostar or Tesoro and what somebody pays at the pump, there are a number of transactions and transportation costs that get added to that, as well as capital costs and employment and overhead and a number of other considerations that are added to that final price at the pump. So to answer your question, no, we don't consider the price of gasoline in the sale of our RIK. We look at to maximize the benefit of the resources to the citizens of the state. And I really wanted to touch on one other question you mentioned earlier about the asphalt, whether that was a consideration. It's not an express consideration, but we did have this go out for a 30-day public comment to the public. We went before the Royalty Board. There's been a very transparent public process the entire time, and we did not receive any comments that suggested that we should consider the asphalt industry in the determination. But I just wanted to put that on the record, that we did have a 30-day public comment period and the Royalty Board presentation, all subject to Open Meetings Act, and was well attended.
Good information. Senator Stoltz.
Just to follow up, Mr. Schein, outside of that 30-day comment period, so other than that public comment period, was the issue of asphalt production ever brought up at any other discussions with the...
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, to my recollection, no. To my knowledge, no. But as Director Feige mentioned, that conversation has come up in the context of Petrostar maybe making improvements at their refinery to make asphalt more available within the state.
So, Madam Chair, it has come up. I just want to make sure that issue has been raised in the process, but not as formally as during the comment period.
That's correct, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that clarification.
Thank you. Could I ask Director Feige to come on the line? Director Feige, a question. It is my understanding that Flint Hills was producing asphalt. When they stopped producing, who has taken over that role, if anyone?
Madam Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, clearly. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, good.
For the record, Corey Feige, Division of Oil and Gas. And Madam Chair, in response to your question, I do not know if that asphalt manufacturing activity was assumed by another operator. To my knowledge, no. However, I would ask that Alex respond to that if he has any information to the counter.
Alex?
Yes. For the record, Alex, Division of Oil and Gas. Madam Chair, to my knowledge, the only discussions we've had was with Petrostar about the future plans to add capacity on the asphalt manufacturing, but I'm not aware of who has taken that activity in the state after Flint Hill.
Thank you very much. That was my understanding also, but you're the experts. Any other questions for Mr. Schein? If not, I would like to invite Tesoro to the table, just to make sure we don't have any questions for them. Cameron Hunt is online, as well as Damron Van Zandt, and Mr. Matt Gill is here with us. Welcome, Mr. Gill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. We do have Damron Van Zandt. He's our Senior Director of North American Crude Buying. Handy for those kind of questions. And we also have Cameron Hunt, our Vice President and Refinery Manager of our Kenai Refinery, who has a wealth of knowledge on asphalt and other local issues. If you'd like, I can go through the prepared remarks and then we can...
That sounds great. Go ahead and go through the prepared remarks first, and then we'll ask either Mr. Hunt or Mr. Vendez the question about asphalt.
All right. So for the record, good afternoon. My name is Matt Gill. I'm the External Affairs Senior Manager for Tesoro Alaska. I'm here today to urge your support for Senate Bill 205, an act approving ratifying sale of royalty oil to the state of Alaska from state Tesoro, effective date. In the way of background, Sora Corporation is currently a Fortune 100 company. We are an independent refiner and marketer of petroleum products. Tesoro's refining operation started in Alaska with purchase of our Kenai refinery back in 1969, so 47 years. Mm. Our Kenai refinery has an operational capacity of up to 72,000 barrels per day. It's primarily focused on jet and diesel production, followed by gasoline and gasoline blend stocks, heating oil, heavy oils, propane, and asphalt. We operate a 68-mile common carrier products pipeline, transports jet fuel, gasoline, diesel fuel to the Port of Anchorage and the Anchorage International Airport. The wholesale delivery of our products occurs through our terminals in Kenai, Anchorage, the Nikiski dock we have, as well as the Port of Anchorage. In addition to being the largest taxpayer in the Kenai Peninsula borough, Tesoro is also able to provide over 225 in-state family wage jobs at the refinery and at our terminals, along with about 30 full-time contractors that are working in and around the refinery year-round. We're a major supporter of the CERCAC, the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, as well as the largest member of CISPRI, the Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response Team. We actively support a wide range of events and programs across the state. In 2015, we gave over $300,000 in grants from our Tesoro Foundation. Our intention is to beat that number in 2016. Each year down on the Kenai Peninsula, we sponsor all the 5th and 6th grade classes to conduct a mission at the Kenai Challenger Learning Center. We're the signature sponsor of the Caring for the Kenai program, as well as a founding sponsor of the Alaska Business Week, which is a statewide business program that gets put on each summer. Tesoro is here to urge you to support Senate Bill 205. This legislation is the result of over a year of dialogue and productive negotiations between Department of Natural Resources and our Tesoro Corporation. By all accounts, we are very impressed with the state's ability to understand our issues and impressed with their ability to come to a mutually beneficial agreement that we think is a win-win, not only for us, but for the state, as well as accommodating to the other in-state refiners. For the state, the DNR estimates will continue to receive a price for its royalty in kind oil that exceeds the price it would receive if elected to keep its royalty oil in value. The estimated additional revenue to the state is between $45 and $56 million for the span of the contract. For Tesoro, this five-year contract will provide us with a stable supply of ANS crude, while also giving us the volumetric flexibility to help accommodate seasonal fluctuations in demand for our refined products. The availability, flexibility, and stability that this contract offers will have a positive impact on our ability to maintain our ongoing operations at our Kenai refinery. In order to accommodate the needs of the other in-state refiners, Tesoro and the state modified this contract to reduce the volumes as well as eliminate a proration clause and the five-year extension option. Tesoro believes in Alaska's future. We're committed to being an active corporate citizen, and we look forward to continuing to provide Alaskans with clean-burning fuels and successfully running our refinery for perhaps another 47 years. I urge you to support Senate Bill 205.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. So who would you recommend we ask the asphalt question to?
That would be best directed to Cameron Hunt, our Vice President and Refinery Manager.
Thank you. Mr. Hunt, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Cameron Hunt, and I am the Vice President of Kenai Refinery for Tesoro Alaska Company.
Thank you. Could you discuss the asphalt production question that perhaps you've been hearing?
Sure. With the shutdown of Flint Hills, I believe that Tesoro has picked up all of the asphalt volume for South Central and the Fairbanks area demand for asphalt for the state. We produced this last summer approximately 430,000 barrels, and we're actually investing in improvements to our load rack to speed up asphalt loading at our plant down here in Kenai, our Nikiski refinery. We're also aware through press releases that PetroStar is building capacity to supply asphalt from their North Pole refinery, but you would have to ask them where they are on that project.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Hunt?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Michiki.
Mr. Hunt,
Good afternoon. What is your percentage of Alaska hire at the Kenai refinery?
Okay, thank you, Senator Machicki. Through the chair, the answer to the senator's question, I don't have a percentage for Alaskan hire. We can't, we're unable to find in market for certain specialty educational backgrounds, such as chemical engineers. We do prefer to do local hire. What I can say is, I can confidently say 100% of our refinery employees, ones that we have hired, do live in the state. I think that's something that the North Slope companies can't necessarily claim. Whenever it's possible to hire locally, we do so, especially in our operations workforce and our trades, our mechanics, carpenters, electricians, I&E. We try and do that within state. We were able to hire on several, actually, after the Flint Hills refinery closed and relocated them down to the Kenai.
Any other questions for Mr. Gill or any of the Tesoro folks? All right, seeing none, I will now open public testimony. I see no one online who has signed up to testify. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 205? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. Committee members, is there any further discussion for DNR or Tesoro? All right, seeing none, Senator Costello, a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 205, Work Order 29-GS2225/alpha from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 205 will move from committee. Please be sure to sign the transmittal document before going. Leaving the meeting. This concludes our agenda for today. This is the last hearing for March. Oh, boy. The next hearing will be Friday, April 1st. It will begin at 3:30. We are working on a committee substitute for Senate Bill 163. If that is ready, that will be the first item on the agenda on Friday. Following that, we're going to have an overview on the subject of food security in Alaska. So with that, we will stand in adjournment. After you sign the document, you can go, of course. Let the record reflect the time is 5:02 p.m.